Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So, as I announced on Friday night, today we're going to be looking at Sutta number 22 in the Majjhima Nikaya, known as the Simile of the Snake. In this particular sutta is a couple of similes, not just the simile of the snake, but also the simile of the raft. It's a very actually profound sutta, one of the ones which people quote from quite often to make points about the Buddha's teachings. And it's interesting that it starts with a monk who was making a claim or making a statement which really went counter to the whole thrust of the Buddha's teachings. And it irritated the Buddha enough that he gave a really nice, powerful talk. I know it's part of even our tradition that if you want a really good talk from one of the great monks, you try and irritate them. So they say, right, we're really going to teach you. And there's a story of, in our tradition of Ajahn Mun, there was one of the monks, because Ajahn Mun hadn't given a talk for such a long time. And so this monk, on purpose, after going on alms round, usually when we come back on alms round, we have to sort of take all the food back, put it out on the table, share it out with everyone before we eat it ourselves. But this monk, on the way back from alms round, picked out a cake or something and started chewing it on the way back from alms round in front of the great teacher. He did it on purpose, because he thought, he hadn't heard a good talk from the teacher for a long time. I'm sure this is going to make him upset. And so what happened, that they called a meeting, and Ajahn Mun gave this really rip-roaring talk. And of course he scolded this monk, but the monk didn't mind, he said, because I got the talk. That's what I really did it for. So similar thing happened here, as we will now find. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park. And those of you going on the pilgrimage to India, we'll visit there. You'll actually see where the Jeta Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park actually is. Now, on that occasion, a pernicious, basically meaning a wrong view, had arisen in a monk named Arita, formerly of the Vulture Killers. So he didn't actually come from all that good background. And this was his false view. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, by the Buddha, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. And if you look at the note to the back, those who've got the books, I'll read out the note to the books. In making this assertion, he directly contradicts the third of the four intrepidities or fearlessness of the Tathagata. According to the commentary, while reflecting in seclusion, he came to the conclusion that there would be no harm if monks were to engage in sexual relations with women, and he maintained that this should not be prohibited by the monastic rules. Though his statement does not expressly mention the sexual issue, the similes about sensual pleasures brought forth later lend credence to the commentary. And in particular, in another commentary, to a similar story by Arita, he said that, well, what's the big deal with sexual matters anyway? So touching a woman is just like touching a soft cloth. That's all there is to it. But let's see what the Buddha said afterwards. Several monks, having heard about this, went to the monk Arita and asked him, "Friend Arita, is it true that such a view has arisen in you?" "Exactly so, friends. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Buddha, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them." Then these monks, designed to detach him from that pernicious or wrong view, pressed and questioned and cross-questioned him thus, "Friend Arita, do not say so. Do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It is not good to misrepresent the Buddha. The Buddha would not speak thus. For in many discourses the Blessed One stated how obstructive things are obstructions, and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. The Buddha, the Blessed One, has stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. With the simile of the skeleton, with the simile of the piece of meat, with the simile of the glass torch, with the simile of the pit of coals, with the simile of the dream, with the simile of the borrowed goods, with the simile of the tree laden with fruit, with the simile of the slaughterhouse, with the simile of the sword stake, with the simile of the snake's head. The Blessed One has stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. So certainly the Arita is claiming that there's no problem with sensual pleasures, and the monks here are reminding Arita of some of these similes. And you find those similes later on. I think it's in, the 54th Sutta of the Majjhimanikaya. But just to go through some of them quickly, the simile of the skeleton was that just as like you give, like a butcher might toss out a bone covered with blood to a hungry dog, and the dog would be able to chew on that bone. He would get that the taste of meat, but would not get the sustenance of meat. He said that's like sensory pleasures. You get the taste and it promises fulfillment, but that's all as far as you get, just the taste, and it never really satisfies you. Just instead of eating meat, it's just like the taste of meat on a bone. That's like the skeleton. The simile of the piece of meat was a simile of a crow who picked up a piece of meat which someone discarded and got attacked by the other crows and the other birds, always pecking at it until it let go of the piece of meat, which is like the competition which is always around with sensory pleasures. And the simile of the grass torch is that the grass torch is fine as long as the wind is behind you, but sometimes the wind changes and what was once very useful and very pleasant to you is now blowing in your face and burning. So it's the uncertainty of sensory pleasures. They're pleasurable first, then afterwards they can burn one quite badly. The simile of the pit of coals, that's actually the simile, if I remember correctly, of in the time of the Buddha, that lepers who had like sores on their body would try and actually cauterize their body by heating them over charcoal. And they say even though it was like painful, they would take it as some type of pleasure. The simile of the dream was just actually the idea that one had all this wonderful dream of beautiful things, beautiful lakes and gardens and trees, and one woke up and found out it wasn't quite that way. And here the Buddha was making the point that sensory pleasures is so much fantasy, so much dream stuff, which is around sensory pleasures, that actually when we really wake up, sometimes we wonder, what the heck are we doing? Much of sensory pleasure is just like a dream. And the simile of the borrowed goods, again, is one of my favorite ones for sensory pleasures, because when you have a sensory pleasure, you're just borrowing happiness, and you have to sort of pay it back afterwards. Whatever sensory pleasure you have, there's always the downside afterwards. And that downside actually is much longer. So it is a borrowing of happiness by excitement in the sensory realm. What comes afterwards, you have to pay back. So some of the other ones, they don't actually... the tree laden with fruit is a simile of a man who goes up a tree, he's got so much fruit, and another man comes along, he's up in the tree collecting his fruit, another man comes along and wants to chop the tree down. And of course, you know, really you should sort of jump out pretty quickly if someone's chopping the tree down. But sometimes sensory pleasures are such, we say, oh, just one more, just one more, just a little bit longer, just a little bit longer. And that's when you get into trouble because of the attachment to the joy of sensory pleasures. When it's dangerous, one can't let it go. So those are some of the similes there. And in particular, it says provide little gratification. There is happiness, pleasure there, obviously, but much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. So the Buddha is actually saying here that with sensory pleasures, they are pleasurable, but there's a lot of danger in them. So if you do like a full analysis, he's saying it's not worth it. And that's again a strong statement which is said by the Buddha about sensuality. It goes against the grain because many people don't want to hear that, but that's what the Buddha said. Any questions about that? Okay. Yet, although pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by them in this way, the monk Arita, formerly of adulterous killers, still obstinately adhered to that pernicious view and continued to insist upon it. Since the monks were unable to detach him from that wrong view, they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, they sat down at one side and told him all that had occurred, adding, "Venerable Sir, since we could not detach the Bhikkhu Aritta, formerly of the vulture killers, from this pernicious or wrong view, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One." Then the Blessed One addressed a certain monk thus, "Come, monk, tell the monk Aritta, formerly of the vulture killers, in my name that the teacher calls him." "Yes, Venerable Sir," he replied, and he went to the monk Aritta and told him, "The teacher calls you, friend Aritta." "Yes, friend," he replied, and went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then asked him, "Aritta, is it true that the following pernicious view has arisen in you? As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them." "Exactly so, Venerable Sir. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, those things called obstructions by the Blessed One are not able to obstruct one who engages in them." "Misguided man, to whom have you..." This is as far as the Buddha can go to really blast somebody. So if you want to be sort of polite and you want to sort of tell off your husband or your wife or your kids, you say, "Misguided son, misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, in many discourses have I not stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them? Have I stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, with the simile of the skeleton, the simile of the piece of meat, the simile of the grass torch, the simile of the pit of coals, the simile of the dream, the simile of the borrowed goods, the simile of the tree laden with fruit, the simile of the slaughterhouse, the simile of the sword snake, with the simile of the snake's head? I have stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them. But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp, and injured yourself and stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Monks, what do you think? Has this monk Aritta, formerly the vulture killers, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dharma and discipline? How could he, Venerable Sir?" "No, Venerable Sir." When this was said, the monk Aritta, formerly the vulture killers, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. The standard when you've made a big mess of things. Then, knowing this, the Blessed One told him, "Misguided man, you'll be recognized by your own wrong view. I still question the monks on this matter." Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Bhikkhus, do you understand the Dhamma taught by me as this Bhikkhu Aritta, formerly the vulture killers, does, when he misrepresents us by his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit?" "No, Venerable Sir, for in many discourses the Blessed One has stated how obstructive things are obstructions and how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. The Blessed One has stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, with the simile of the skeleton and all those other similes, up to the simile of the snake's head. The Blessed One has stated how great is the danger in them." "Good monks, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me thus, for in many discourses I have stated how obstructive things are obstructions, how they are able to obstruct one who engages in them. I have stated how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering and much despair, and how great is the danger in them, with all those similes. I have stated how great is the danger in these things. But this monk, Aritta, formerly the vulture killers, misrepresents us by his wrong grasp, and injures himself, and stores up much demerit, for this will lead to the misguided man's harm and suffering for a long time." Now the Buddha actually says something very powerful. "Bhikkhus, that one can engage in sensual pleasures without sensual desires, without perceptions of sensual desire, without thoughts of sensual desire, that is impossible. So he's talking about the sensual pleasures. But when there's those sensual pleasures, there obviously will be sensual desires, perceptions, and sensual thoughts. So these are, the Buddha says, obstructions. Obstructions to meditation, obstructions to freedom. I think many of you have heard me say before, the two types of freedom to be found in the world is the freedom of desire, where your desires can run rampant and you can actually fulfill every desire you want. It's called the freedom of desire. The other freedom is the freedom from desire, where then there's no desires arise, where you're not under the power of those desires. And the teaching of the Buddha is leading us to the freedom from desires. We say when there's sensual pleasures, there'll be sensual desires, there'll be sensual thoughts. There won't be that peace and that freedom from those thoughts, which many of you may have already touched in your meditation. So, any questions? Yeah. Correct, yes. This is when, just before I left Thailand to come to Australia, when Ajahn Chah was still teaching, somebody came from the West and they said, well, yeah, we can actually practice sensuality, especially sex, but we're just not attached to it. And Ajahn Chah said, well, if you can show me someone who can actually find salt, which isn't salty, then I may be able to believe you. And that was Ajahn Chah's response. Salt is always salty. And so sexuality is always with attachments. With sensual desires, perception of sensual desires, with thoughts of sensual desires. That's right, yes. Correct, yeah. It's a force, as a psychologist would say, you're in denial. It's called wishful thinking. You know, we always want to think we're free from these things. And again, this idea of freedom is a fascinating thing to actually for us to contemplate. And the Buddha is actually looking at a very true freedom. But for many people, when you're free to indulge in your sexuality, to be able to eat whatever you want, do whatever you want, do people really feel free? And why don't they feel free? And it's because those desires, they keep pulling and pulling you. So you're not free of the desires. That is the bindings, those are the attachments, those are the fetters, the inside fetters, which stop you being free. So yes, it actually does make that very powerful point, which goes against tantric practices. Yeah. I remember that in those days, similar to Europe, that would be like his surname. He's part of the Vulture Killer clan. Just as the same way that somebody may be Mr. Baker, or what's your surname? It's, blacksmith, yeah, Mr. Engineer. So, yes, I just think you because what George, what does George do? But each one, like we used to actually have the surnames actually representing our family profession, and usually the son would actually carry on in the footsteps of the father, and so the Vulture Killers would be a clan. Exactly what they did, we're not really quite sure, but it could be that vultures were considered to be pests, and these people be the ones who actually get rid of the vultures. But it's obviously, it was from the intimation, it was like a low clan, a low family, and that's probably why they put it down there. As if, what can you expect from someone from such a clan? There was, obviously, a social hierarchy in the time of the Buddha, even though the Buddha actually railed against it and always would say that a person would be judged by their actions, by their sila, not by their family. But there was, at that time, obviously a hierarchy, a social hierarchy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, it's actually, there's one strange one where the Buddha actually reproached Devadatta towards the end of his life. And it's, you know, sometimes you think it's out of character, but it's in the suttas, and it said, you're just like someone to be spat out like a lump of spittle. Which is, that's going a bit strong. And that was actually noted by King Melinda in the Melinda's questions, and say, wasn't that sort of going a bit too far? The actual, the word for misguided man is like moga purisa, like, you know, you're blinded, you're not seeing properly. And like the translation of misguided is quite a beautiful translation. So if you're not really blaming the person, it's just you've been misguided, so we're going to try and guide you better. Yeah? Well, no, this is the same. Yeah, same translation, moga purisa. But again, it's something which comes up quite often when people actually think that to get to the full enlightenment, that you can still have your sensuality. Remember, we're supposed to be leaving the world, leaving attachment, leaving craving, and that's one of the big cravings. And now, this is one of the great similes of the Buddha. And of course, the Buddha is really, you can see he's not so much vile, but he's, you know, we just get to stop this before it actually takes hold. And so he gives some very powerful teachings coming on next. Here, monks, some misguided men learn the Dhamma, and here he actually gives some of the description of the Dhamma. Discourses, stanzas, expositions, verses, exclamations, sayings, burst stories, marvels, and answers to questions. And any of you who know Ajahn Sujato, and have listened to his talks, he's actually looked at these lists here as if this were some original structure of the Buddha's teachings. You know, before we had the Tripitaka, certainly that I accept that in original Buddhism there was not a Tripitaka, but only a Dvipitaka, the two Pitakas. There wasn't any Abhidhamma at the time of the Buddha. That's fairly certain. But he was saying, even the way it's been adapted into the Sutta Pitaka, he said the earlier way of arranging the teachings was in these particular categories of discourses, that's the sutta, stanzas, which is like gaya, literally means to be sung, expositions, which means basically like question and answers, the verses, these are the gathas, the poems, exclamations called udana, and there's a whole book called the udana, sayings is the iti wutaka, the birth stories, the very famous jataka. So I often actually quote that. Some people who say the jataka came a long time after the Buddha, there was obviously some jataka, some birth stories, which were actually part of the original Buddhism. Marvels, this is abhuta dhamma, miracles. That also, according to this, was original to Buddhism in the very beginning. There was some miraculous thing which the Buddha would sometimes talk about. And Vedala, just again, another type of questions and answers. Vedala was more like question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. Whereas Vayakarana, one question would actually give rise to a whole sutta, a whole discourse. So it's interesting there seems to be like a very early arrangement of the teachings of the Buddha into those different categories. But anyway, here monks, some misguided men learn the Dhamma, but having learned the Dhamma, they do not examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Not examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they do not gain a reflective acceptance of them. Instead, they learn the Dhamma only for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates. And they do not experience the good for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Those teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. So this is a person who just learns these things, probably for the sake of getting a degree, you know, at university, to be able to criticize others and point out other people's mistakes. But they don't really examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. And because of that, they don't get the reflective acceptance of them. The reflective acceptance is really understand what all about, so you have a map for your own inner journey of meditation. And instead, they only learn the Dhamma for the sake of criticizing others. So they're using it for the wrong means. And here the Buddha comes with his famous simile of a snake. Suppose a man, needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and grasped its coils or its tail. It would turn back on him and bite his hand or his arm or one of his limbs. And because of that, he would come to death or deadly suffering. Why is that? Because of his wrong grasp of the snake. So too, here some misguided men learn the Dhamma, and only for the purpose of criticizing others and winning debates. Those teachings, being wrongly grasped by them, conduce to their harm and suffering for a long time. On the alternative, here monks, some clansmen, learn the Dhamma in all these categories, the discourses, stanzas, expositions, verses, exclamations, sayings, birth stories, marvels and answers to questions, and having learned the Dhamma, they examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Examining the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they gain a reflective acceptance of them. And they do not learn the Dhamma for the sake of criticizing others or for winning in debates, and thus they experience the good for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Those teachings, being rightly grasped by them, conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Suppose a man needing a snake, seeking a snake, wandering in search of a snake, saw a large snake and caught it rightly with a cleft stick, and having done so, grasped it rightly by the neck. Then although the snake might wrap its coils around his hand or his arm or his limbs, still he would not come to death or deadly suffering because of that. Why is that? Because of his right grasp of the snake. So too, here some clansmen learn the Dhamma. And they, having learned the Dhamma, they examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom. Examine the meaning of those teachings with wisdom, they gain a reflective acceptance of them. They do not learn the Dhamma for the sake of criticizing others and for winning in debates. And thus they experience the good for the sake of which they learn the Dhamma. Those teachings, being rightly grasped by them, conduce to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Therefore, monks, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. And when you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask either me about it or those monks who are wise. So that this is how to grasp the Dhamma properly and not to grasp it like a tail of a snake, which will just bite you afterwards. Is that quite clear? Any questions? Okay, what comes up next is one of the other very famous and powerful teachings of the Buddha, the simile of the raft. Bhikkhus, I shall show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sir, the monks replied. The Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. Then he thought, there is this great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear. But there is no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And so the man did collect grass, twigs, branches and leaves, and bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus: this raft has been very helpful to me, since, supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, monks, what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with the raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with the raft? Here, monks, when that man go across and arrived at the far shore, he might think thus: this raft has been very helpful to me, since, supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land, or set it adrift in the water. In other words, let it go, and then go wherever I want. Now, monks, it is by so doing that the man will be doing what should be done with the raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Because when you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even good states. How much more so bad states? Now, that's a very powerful teaching. But before I'd open it up for any questions, I'd always make the observation, which many monks make, that you're supposed to abandon the raft only after you've got across the expanse of water. Not before. Unfortunately, people may abandon it before they've even started, or at least halfway in the midstream, and then they become called misguided men. There's powerful teaching there about the Dhamma. Is, again, first of all, it's not for arguing with people. That's actually like grasping the Dhamma by the wrong end, like grasping the snake by the tail. So if people have got different opinions to you, you don't go around sort of arguing and pointing out their faults. The Dhamma is not some interest to argue around a coffee table to see who's right and who's wrong. So the Dhamma is there for crossing across, going from suffering to freedom, going from attachment to detachment, for becoming enlightened. Crossing the shore means becoming enlightened. Only then can you actually let go of that Dhamma. I say that you should abandon even good states. How much more so bad states? And it's very important actually to see exactly why we're saying that in a few moments, what the abandoning means. You may have heard me say that the reason why we attach to things is the same reason why we pick up things with a hand. It's what a hand does, is to pick up things. If you have a hand, you will pick up things. So if you have a self, then you will attach to things. That's what a self does. So the only way actually to let go of, abandon even good states as well as bad states, is to let go of the thing doing the attaching. To abandon the self. And that's the only way that both bad states and good states are abandoned. Is that quite clear? When there's a self, there's always be attachments. Because that's what a self does. Accumulates things. Isn't that what you do? Any questions on that so far before we go to the standpoints of views, which is all about self coming up? No? You know what it says here? And paragraph 12, therefore, monks, when you understand the meaning of my statements, remember it accordingly. When you do not understand the meaning of my statements, then ask. Paragraph 12. Okay. Okay, we carry on there. You must all understand exactly what's being said. But please always remember that similar to the raft. After you've crossed over, then you let go. But why do you let go? And what's letting go? And who's letting go? This is where we get these standpoints for views coming next. Go on. Yeah, I think you got first. Well, here it says, when you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even the good states. And obviously that means the good Dhammas. How much more so than the bad Dhammas? So it's equating like the sensuality to being something which is like an unwholesome Dhamma, sort of a useless Dhamma. So you're saying, if you're going to have to abandon even the good states, then surely you should have to abandon the bad states as well. Like jhanas, bliss. But why would you abandon those? Now you can actually see what the abandonment really means. The abandonment really means is when there's a self there, then actually those things become almost part of you. That you become the one who can achieve the jhanas. You become the one who has good wisdom, good understanding. You become the one who is the compassionate one. And that is actually where one attaches to the good states. And I think that many of you have probably had enough experience now to know what happens when you even attach to the good states. And I am the compassionate one. The trouble is that sometimes you're not, and then you get upset about yourself. We make a self of this, and that creates an enormous amount of turmoil inside. We can't maintain it. And we get proud, or we get disappointed, we get depressed. So again, that's grasping the snake by the tail, it will turn around and bite you. See, even the Dhamma was like a snake. If you misgrasp the Dhamma, it can even bite you. So don't even grasp the compassion as being me. Look at me, I'm the great jhana expert. Look at me, I'm the sort of compassionate one. Look at me, I'm just so wise. That's grasping. You can see when it's a grasping. Too often, actually, when we talk upon grasping and attachment, we look at actually either what we're attaching to, or actually the process of attaching. One thing which I always pointed out is that there's another end of attachment which people actually very rarely look at. What's doing the attaching? Not the object, what we're attached to. I'm attached to my money, I'm attached to my fame, I'm attached to my family. You can see the objects. We actually very often look at the relationship between those objects, but it's the I inside. What's doing the attaching? And that's the most important thing to look at. Because once the attacher is abandoned, then of course one cannot attach again. And that's when the abandoning happens. And that's why going across, it's like abandoning the self. Abandoning the one who does the abandoning and the attaching. So this is where the raft is let go of. Yeah, go on. But you use the good states as your raft to get across. So use that attachment as your raft, but then you attach to your raft. You cling to it. That's also flawed, yes. But you use those states. You use the happiness of being a good person, inspiration. You use the happiness of generosity. You use the happiness of thinking you're getting somewhere on the path. When you come to the far shore, you have to let go of the raft. You have to abandon even the good states. Because the good states, if you're attaching to those good states, it means there's someone doing the attaching there. The self is still operative. This is where one has to let go of the whole lot. Not just the good states, not just the bad states, but the good states as well. Correct. Yeah, it's almost like a means to an end. You get rid of the bad states. Then you develop the good states. Then you let go of the good states. But only when you've passed over, not halfway along the stream. Yeah. It's interesting that whether far shore actually means full enlightenment. There's some suttas where, to me, I interpret it as meaning the state of non-returning, sort of, which is like it's a little bit short of the full enlightenment, but it's still where one has abandoned all sensuality, all ill will, all sense of a self. But there one is still attaching to the good states, of the jhana states basically, the bliss of the mind. However, that because of the nature of this particular sutta, and because it does say abandoning even the good states, all the good states as well as the bad states, this far shore obviously means full enlightenment. Well, it's just saying not what you do, but what happens. The good states are abandoned. So having noticed the good states are abandoned at that point, it's quite clear that the bad states also have to be abandoned. But this is actually, we explained in a bit more detail. And it's interesting that as soon as we've had a simile of the raft, the next couple of paragraphs are always coming along to the sense of self. Two or three paragraphs here. We start off with the standpoints for views. And these are actually all views of a self. Amongst, there are these six standpoints for views, like places where views of a self can grow. What are these six? Here, monks, an untaught ordinary person, which is the way the Buddha says, someone who's not a stream winner or above. Here, monks, an untaught ordinary person who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in the Dhamma, who has no regard for true men and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, they regard material form, basically the body and things. They regard material form thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. They regard feeling. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. This is the Vedana, the quality of happiness or suffering which come with every sense consciousness. They regard perception thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. They regard mental formations, such as will. Chedana is one of the prominent of these mental formations. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. They regard what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized. They regard what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And this standpoint of view is namely, this is self, this is the world. After death, I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. I shall endure as long as eternity. This too he regards thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. So we have here like six ways where the person is actually making a self, rather regarding the self or what belongs to the self as material form, just as your body, by the feelings of pleasure and pain which come from time to time, even our perceptions, our mental formations such as will. And also we have what you may call the objects of the mind, what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And lastly, this is the self, this is the world, referring to actually some idea of a consciousness. This is the self, this is the world, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity. This too he regards thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. Those three parts of the view of a self, this is mine. In other words, this belongs to a self. Maybe this might not be identical to a self, but this is one of the attributes or the possessions of a self. As if there's some soul, some essence which owns your body, which owns feelings, our perceptions, thoughts, everything which is cognized. That means this is mine. It is from the place of mine where the attachments and the craving come. That's why we don't like to abandon things when we think, this is mine. So that's the standpoint of views, which the Buddha says is a wrong standpoint of views. This is me, is always the explained by the Buddha, to be the foundation for the three types of conceit. I am better, I am the same, I am worse. This is where we measure ourselves. We measure ourselves maybe by our body. Look how beautiful or strong, fit, young I am. We measure it by our feelings. I'm the happy monk. You measure it by some of your perceptions, by your abilities in your formations, your thoughts, your will, your strength of will, or by what you actually experience. These are all ways we measure ourselves. I am better, I am the same, I am worse. All the three types of conceit, which is what the Buddha is referring to here, is this I am. And this is myself, is a philosophical standpoint which looks at any one of these things as being like a soul, a permanent essence, which travels from life to life. And that is expanded upon in the sixth view. When it says this is the self, this is the world, that's actually a wrong translation, which Bhikkhu Bodhi, you may have a new book, that's actually changed that in the newer books, to say the self and the world are the same. After death, I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. I shall endure as long as eternity. So these are the forms of a self. When the Buddha talks about a view, especially what the wrong views, they always come from an assumption of a self somewhere in there. They say these are the foundations for the view of me, mine and self. Yeah? All attachments are suffering. All attachments either are suffering or they lead to suffering. Does that make sense? Okay. In other words, that just in the attaching themselves, there's a sense of putting yourself in the jail, tying yourself down. So in that sense, there is suffering, in the sense of it's a loss of happiness, a loss of freedom. There's also the attachments which you can say lead to suffering. They lead to the sense of being bound, they lead to even physical pain, let alone mental pain, because what one attaches to will eventually disappear. Just like the attachment we have to our loved ones. I mentioned that they lead to suffering because you've got the example of somebody falling in love. You can't say that when they're attached to somebody they experience suffering. Because you ask them, they will deny that. They'll say, it's the most wonderful time of my life. I'm in love. They say it's conducive to suffering, because that love will have to change. And what was once a very great pleasure will fade away. And even if it doesn't turn into sort of the acrimony of a divorce, still the very fact that you've lost something very precious gives rise to a sense of disappointment. And even... what's the word? Frustration. Does that make sense? Oh, I see what you mean there. Attachment to the good. Yeah, okay, yeah, fair enough, yes. An attachment, it is, again, in the sense suffering at the time, but it's an attachment of suffering which leads to the end of suffering. I see what you mean there. Because the word actually attachment, the word is upadana, but it also literally means taking up. It means actually literally picking up. Like adana, as many of you know in the second precept, adina adana. Adina means not giving, not given. Adana means taking what's not given. So adana means like taking. And upa is the same, pretty similar to the English word up, means taking up. But it also has this beautiful meaning of like a fuel, just like the fire takes up the oil or the gasoline. And it's also used in Buddhism as the meaning of a fuel. So upadana, attachment or grasping, it also has this idea of like a fuel. And so what actually fueling existence? And that's one of the meanings of upadana. So you can see there are some types of attachments which actually fuel more suffering in the future. And actually the suffering of future rebirth. But there are some fuels which actually do not, some attachments which do not fuel more rebirth. And those are like the attachments to the raft which crosses over. So even though there is some suffering involved, it's not a suffering which will create more rebirth. Is that answer? Okay. Yeah. Indeed, yes. But again, imagine like abandoning means like you don't own them. And if you actually look upon abandoning as like disowning them, then you get some good idea of what is really talking about there. It's the sense of I has been disappeared. So you don't own them, you don't possess those good states as like a personal attribute. So the jhanas are, the bliss is, but it's not my bliss, it's not my jhanas. It's not that I am the arahat. Does that make sense to you? Not yet. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Again, I can see your point there. The thing is that you don't do anything on those states. These things, it becomes the old natural process which you've heard me talk about before. But the abandoning is that you don't do it anymore. Make sense? You're abandoning, I have to do these good states. They're not, don't become part of you. That makes sense there. Okay. But remember, this is the abandoning. The abandoning can only happen of the abandoning of good states. If the abandoner, the one who does the attaching and the abandoning, is completely gone. This is the sense of self which is coming up from these standpoints of views. I'm making a point here that after the simile of the raft, the Buddha sort of almost starts to explain what that simile means by talking about sort of non-self and say, explaining like abandoning the good states can only happen is actually by abandoning the good states and the bad states can only happen if like all abandoning is disappearing. It means the attacher has gone. You're abandoning it at the root. You're cutting off that which does the attaching. Literally, you're abandoning the I. Yes, John? Correct, you have to attached to your raft to actually to go across. And of course that raft, elsewhere it's made very clear that that raft is the Eightfold Path. That is the raft which you bind together, which you use the effort to actually to pull yourself across. So you have to attach to that raft, as Rodney was pointing out quite well. It's an attachment which is an attachment to doing good, which leads to the end of the identification of the I, of the self, the me, the mine. And with that, then the stream is crossed and automatically all the good states and the bad states are abandoned because there's no I to do those things anymore. You can't attach because there's no one to do the attaching. The hand cannot pick up because there's no hand left anymore. Part of the Eightfold Path, yeah, the last factor is all about the jhanas. But oh yeah, that's what I always say. Yeah. So to actually to really understand non-self, you have to actually follow the Eightfold Path, and one of those is actually the factor of jhanas. You need that experience to be able to fully understand non-self. Okay. Oh yes, go on. Sometimes it can cause suffering, but sometimes it cannot cause suffering. It can be one of those attachments to, you know, like right thought of a path, a right view. Because we, if one is remembering the loved ones from the past with a sense of loving kindness, with a sense of doing one's duty, and also remembering just as they are now passed away, one day we will be passing away, then that's actually a very skillful way of remembering. So I think for many people, I found that's very useful to do a reflection on, you know, your relations who passed away. It's not actually causing suffering, but causing a sense of maybe the end of suffering, dealing with the problem of grief, letting it go, and then afterwards developing the state of gratitude. When I think of my deceased relations who have passed away, I don't feel grief about them, but I feel great gratitude. And that gratitude, that positive mind state, is a very beautiful one to take one into deep meditation. That sort of makes the... I suppose what you're saying is true, but it depends how you look at the those ceremonies. Yeah. 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 Well, you got actually. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's probably that you have to get on the raft, attached to your raft first of all, and then when you're over the grief, then you can let that one go. Indeed, yes. And I think that each one of us has probably lived long enough to actually to show how many attachments have burned us. You know, when because of our attachments, we've invested so much in what is really uncertain. It's like playing a lottery, whose outcome we actually cannot predict. Or one thing we can predict maybe is the attachment will eventually be beyond our control. Because a lot of attachment is about controlling and ownership. Because when you actually, I like the word ownership, because that really makes it very clear there's a self in there. And controlling, you know, what you own is what you control. Correct, yeah. It's not just the outcome, it's also the income as well. Because it's, you know, the self gets a sense of being by its attachments, by its cravings, by its own, what it owns. And that's why I always observe the ones who have the big egos are the ones who like to control a lot. The ones who have little egos, they don't control anybody. They don't tell you off, they don't tell you what to do. Because they're not controlling anymore. That's a sign of detachment. Yeah? No. Correct, yes. But sometimes you find that you can have right speech, you can have right livelihood, you can have right actions, you keep the precepts, but sometimes you find you don't do it from time to time because it's not coming from the deep understanding of there's not a self, it's not the deep understanding of detachment, of no controlling. But you always notice that most of the breaking of precepts is because of controlling, owning, or frustration of your lack of control, which is where ill will comes from. And when you realize there's no controlling in there anyway, so you don't try and get angry at the world, which is all like results of a frustrated control. So let's go a little bit further, because time's going by. Oh, yeah. 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 Well, sometimes they do get in those positions in organisations. It's not the fact they're in those positions, it's actually how they deal in those positions, the way they carry out those positions. You can be like a person in a family that can have a huge ego. You have a person in a corporation who is not sort of such a control freak. Sometimes, well, I'm not sure how the corporations actually get to those positions. Sometimes it may be your father might inherit it from your father or something and you get put in there. I'm not sure. I'm sure there's anomalies. I agree with you. Most people actually have to fight tooth and nail to get to be the head of the corporation. So it's encouraging people who are sometimes unethical, who want to control a lot, who have the big egos. Correct, yeah. The same, I mean, you may have not be in any position at all, but still be a control freak. But it's usually, the ones with the big egos would usually gravitate to those big positions. Yeah. I'm not sure it depends actually how he does it. I'm not sure. Yeah. 'Cause I don't know too much about that organisation. Only sort of hearsay, but if they're a big control freak, yeah, too much attachment. Oh yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. Well, sometimes great leaders, they delegate. So they say, "You go and do it. You go and do it." That's not controlling. Yeah. I'm not quite sure because I don't know what she did and how she controlled it. It really depends on how much, like, delegation is a good sign of you not controlling. But I think you get the, instead of having specific examples, which I'm not quite sure of the details of each of those examples you've mentioned, but what one can say is the general principle is that the controlling and the wanting to control, that's actually a sign of ego. It's attachment. What's yours is what you tend to control. Okay, we go a bit further. Bhikkhus, this is paragraph 16. A well-taught noble disciple who has regard for noble ones and is skilled and disciplined in the Dhamma, who has regard for true men and is skilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, this is like the stream winner and above. Their regards material form thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. He regards feeling, Vedana, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. He regards perception, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. He regards formations, mental formations, such as will. It also includes thinking, thought. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. He regards what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, encountered, sought, mentally pondered thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And this down points for views, namely, this is self, this is the world. So, after death I should be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. I should endure as long as eternity. This too, even that view, he regards, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Since he regards them thus, he is not agitated about what is not existent. Fascinating little saying the Buddha gives out every now and again. So we will be agitated if we think these things are existing when they don't exist. But he said these things don't exist, so you're not agitated about them anymore. Okay, the new translation was, this is self, that the self and the world are the same.
This is self,
that the self and the world are the same. So after a death, just as the world will carry on, so I will carry on. Many people actually, I'm not quite sure if this is what the Buddha meant, but one interpretation of that is actually to see that, you know, that you will never die, that, you know, you'll always be in the your children, in the lives of their children, that, you know, your imprint on the world will always remember. Enduring, yes. But when the truth of the matter is, usually after two or three generations, you'll be completely forgotten. And no one ever knew you existed. They'll probably dig up your gravestone or your epitaph because they need more space at Karakata. And they just grind it into dust to make, you know, some concrete building somewhere. It's better when you forgot when you're alive. Especially if you regard them thus, because you're not agitated about what's not existed anyway. Yes, right, yeah. Yeah? Oh. Yeah, it means it's referring to what's this, is referring to what's just been taught before. Material form, the body, is referring to the next one is Vedana, to perception, to mental formations. Elsewhere, they make it quite clear, consciousness, such as in the second sermon, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. So they're saying each one of these things, that is not me, that is not mine, that is not a self. Here, actually, they make an interesting departure. They have the first four khandhas, but the fifth khandha of consciousness is not specifically mentioned here, but is specifically mentioned in other suttas as well. So we can actually always include that in there, even consciousness, that which knows, that which is hearing me right now. But that is not a self. That is not me. That is not mine. So each one of these things, and the Buddha is very... very clear and very extensive with all the things which he says. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not self. He doesn't leave anything. In the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, he says, you know, for example, like all consciousness, far and near, refined and unrefined, gross and subtle, the past, present and future, all consciousness is not me, not mine, not a self. So the way he puts it is very clear that there's no possible way that you can actually posit a self anywhere. All avenues are taken out. Does that mean? Because this is always referring to just what's gone before, in a way. Well, again, the Buddha was there, obviously, and so he could understand. And he was certainly saying that things like consciousness, mind, perception, will, those were certainly discounted as a self. I think that's enough for us for the time being. Actually, to see further that in other places, in other suttas, they say that all of that is completely destroyed. So that we only can know from our experience of, you know, this world, but all of that, everything you could know, is all gone. So this is actually what is saying, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not a self. I think it was elsewhere that, I think just trying to remember it, which is a sutta, where it says, you know, is there something outside of the five khandhas? As the Buddha said, no, what it is, not outside. So in other words, basically the Buddha was trying to say that this is not a self, this is not a self, this is not a self, this is not a self. And of course that some people can say, well, it may be something the Buddha never said, and that was the self. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter if you just think that consciousness is not a self and the objects of consciousness is not a self. It is not different than consciousness. The Buddha actually made that very clearly in many statements. He said, that which people call mind, that which people call a self. So that which people call mind or consciousness or perception. So this is actually, it's the wrong view number 26, no, wrong view number 8, sorry, in the 63 wrong views of the Brahmajala Sutta. It's the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya. There's also another sutta, which is, he said it's very easy for a very, many people can see that the body is not a self. Not me, not mine, not a self. Because they can see people dying. But he said that some people still think the chitta, the mind, is a self, a mere mind. But he said that that is also wrong. He said that if anything, this mind is seen changing every few seconds. Surely you should be able to see that because it changes, the mind, the chitta, cannot be a me, cannot be a mind, cannot be a self. So there's many other suttas where the Buddha makes it very plain that he's exhaustive in all of the things which he describes as not being me, not being mine, not being a self. In particular, he uses the five khandhas so often because that was the description, the dissection of the body and the mind. And really you can't actually get anything other than that. I mean, what else can you have other than sort of material form? Vedana, feeling, perception, consciousness, and the objects of consciousness, the mental formations. Sometimes people say it's ineffable simply because sort of they're trying to posit sort of a self, and they're just trying to use words which have no meaning. One of the nice things which I found about the teachings of the Buddha was not mysterious. He wouldn't say, oh, just when you get enlightened then you'll know. Because that's actually sometimes why I think you've heard me, why I rejected Christianity. Because when I ask them what God is, they say, oh, God's ineffable. Now when you sort of die then you'll know. It all seemed to be a bit of a con at the time. And I think the Buddha never said it in that way. The Nibbana was attainable in this very life. You can know what Nibbana is, and the Arahats know what Nibbana are. Even the stream winners know exactly what it is. It's a non-self, nothing there. Emptiness, if you like. So, but anyway, this particular sutta here is actually quite clear that the Buddha is actually saying that each of these things, he's got the first four khandhas, and it's also added on to that, whatever is seen, heard, sensed, even cognized by the mind, anything you can know, encountered, sought, mentally pondered, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And he's calling that as a standpoint for the wrong views. Now, when this was said, a certain one cast a blessed one, venerable sir, can there be agitation about what is non-existent externally? There can be, the Blessed One said. Here, monk, someone thinks thus. Alas, I had it. I have it no more. Alas, may I have it, and I do not get it. Then he sorrows, in other words, what's externally about things. Say, alas, may I have a cup of tea? Alas, I don't get it. Alas, I had a cup of tea earlier, and someone's taken it away. So that's just an example of something external. And then he sorrows, grieves, laments, he weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. This is how there is agitation about what is no existent externally. Venerable sir, can there be no agitation about what is non-existent externally? There can be, monks. The Blessed One said, here, monks, someone does not think thus. Alas, I had it. Alas, I have it no longer. Alas, may I have it? Alas, I do not get it. Not all wanting, and frustrated wanting. Then he does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. That is how there's no agitation about what is non-existent externally. Venerable sir, can there be agitation about what is non-existent internally? There can be, Bhikkhu, the Blessed One said. Here, monk, someone has a view. This is self, this is the world. After death, I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. I shall endure as long as eternity. And the self view. He hears the Tathagata, or a disciple of the Tathagata, Tathagata is another word for the Buddha, teaching the Dhamma for the elimination of all standpoints. You've already got the standpoints there, the standpoints for views. Elimination of all those standpoints. Decisions, obsessions, adherences, and underlying tendencies. For the stilling of all formations. For the relinquishing of all attachment. For the destruction of craving, for dispassion, for cessation, for nibbana. He thinks thus, so I shall be annihilated. I shall perish, so I shall be no more. Then he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. That is how there is agitation about what is non-existent internally. So it's quite clear what the Buddha is saying there. It is because there's nobody in there anyway, there's no one to be destroyed. However, if one still thinks there's somebody in there, and you start hearing these teachings of the Buddha, you think, I'm going to be destroyed. I'm not going to be anymore. I work all this hard work to become enlightened. I'm not going to be able to enjoy it when I get there. It's really unfair. That is how there's agitation about what is non-existent internally. Yeah. Go on. Yeah. Because they've got no choice. The truth is truth. The human being has got this wonderful inclination actually to find out the truth of things. And no matter what cost, we want to know. And so, you know, whether we're content or not content, sometimes that people go on these great adventures, even though they go through a great deal of torment and trial. Because of the desire to know, desire to get to the truth. So the contentment actually, but it's also another point, the way of contentment, you go to more and more contentment, which is a path of jhanas, more and more happiness. So now I was very content when I was a lay person, but the meditation was the highest happiness which I'd achieved. So I wanted to get deeper into that. So it went deeper and deeper into the meditation. As you go deep into the meditation, the more you let go, the more blissful you feel. And you just come across non-self as a truth. You can't miss it if you do a lot of deep meditations. And so whether you like it or not, you know, you find out. So this is what the Buddha is saying. This is actually the next one. Is there can be no, how can there be no agitation about what is non-existent eternal? There can be, monk. The Blessed One said, here, monk, someone does not have the view. This is self. I shall endure as long as eternity. You don't think you exist. He hears the Tathagata or a disciple of the teacher. Sorry, he hears the Tathagata or a disciple of the Buddha teaching the Dhamma for the elimination of all standpoints, decisions, obsessions, adherences, and underlying tendencies, for the stilling of all formations, for the relinquishing of all attachments to the good and the bad. The destruction of craving, for dispassion, for cessation, for nibbana, he does not think, so I shall be annihilated, so I shall perish, so I shall be no more. He doesn't think that. Therefore he does not sorrow, grieve, lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. That is how there is no agitation about what is not existent internally. The difference between the two, in paragraph 20 and 21, is that whether that you have the view of a self. Those who have the view of the self do get scared by these teachings. I just You know, I've been going to Singapore. I've been teaching just, you know, ordinary teachings in Singapore for a while. You know, Two Bad Bricks and Door of My House Open to You, those sorts of teachings, which are very nice. But on one occasion, they asked me, can we give a really deep talk? So I let them have it on non-self. And a few of them, they didn't sleep that night. They were agitated. So I shall be annihilated. I shall perish. There shall be no more. They literally sorrowed, grieved, lament. They weep, beaten their breasts, and became distraught. They were agitated about what was non-existent internally, as you probably would be. So, and the Buddha doesn't let up. He keeps on going. Impermanence and non-self. Bhikkhus, you may well acquire that possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and that might endure as long as eternity. You acquire a possession which is eternal. But do you see any such possession, monks? No, venerable sir. Good monks, I too do not see any possession that is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and that might endure as long as eternity. Because you may well cling to that doctrine of self that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. But do you see any such doctrine of self, monks, that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it? No, venerable sir. Good monks, I too do not see any doctrine of a self, whether mind is a self, or the body is a self, or anything is a self, that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who clings to it. Because you may well take as a support that view that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who takes it as a support. But do you see any such support of views? Again, this always means in the ditty in Pali, a self in there somewhere. No, venerable sir. Good monks, I too do not see any support of views that would not arouse sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair in one who takes it as a support. The standpoints for views is what is meaning there. Bhikkhus, oh, this is one of my favorite sayings from the Buddha. This is a hugely deep sutta. We've got quite a lot to go yet, but who cares? Bhikkhus, there being a self, would there be what belongs to myself? Yes, venerable sir. Or there being what belongs to a self, would there be myself? Yes, venerable sir. This is actually one way where you can actually find out what you actually mean by me, by yourself, by what belongs to you. What do you own? Sometimes we try and find out the idea of a self by who am I. Put that aside, you get much deeper into say, what do I own? What do I possess? What have I got? And that's actually where you come much closer to actually the illusion of a self. Because when there is a self, there will be something which belongs to a self. When there's something which belongs to a self, then there's a self there. If you have no belongings, then there's no self left. Letting go is the end of the self. We define ourselves in a very profound way by what belongs to us. Our parents, our children, our possessions, our intelligence, our experience, our mind. Does that belong to you? Anyway, bhikkhus, since a self and what belongs to a self are not apprehended as true and established, then the standpoints for views, namely, this is self, so the self and the world are the same, after death I shall be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, I shall endure as long as eternity. Would it not be an utterly and completely foolish teaching? What else could it be, venerable sir? It would be an utterly and completely foolish teaching. Because what do you think? Is material form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, suffering and subject to change, fit to be regarded thus? This is me, mine. This I am, this is myself. No, venerable sir, that's material form. Because what do you think? Is feeling, is perception, our formations, is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. No, Venerable Sir. Therefore, bhikkhus, any kind of material form whatever, this is what I was mentioning earlier, this is the same as the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Buddha's second sermon, which enlightened the first five monks. Therefore, monks, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all material form should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Any kind of feeling whatever, any kind of perception whatever, any kind of formations whatever, which includes your will. I'm just going to go on to that will. All will, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all will should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Any kind of consciousness whatever, whether past, future or present, any kind, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Seeing thus, monks, a well-taught noble disciple becomes disenchanted with material form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with formations, including will, disenchanted with consciousness. Being disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. They understand birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. This is the essence of enlightenment. Any questions before I go on? No, you just, everything's going. What's bliss anyway? It's just a Vedana. That's just seen. It's not me, not mine, not a self. It doesn't belong to you. So only when you can let go, you can even touch that bliss. If you try and do it, make it happen, you'll never get anywhere close. Will is not you. It's just you become just part of this process. And there's no Chris in there. The more you let go, the more free you feel. Being disenchanted becomes dispassionate. To dispassionate, your mind is liberated. When it's liberated, there comes the knowledge is liberated. You're free. Yeah? Now, this is, what is the meaning that when this is looked at, this is seen, that none of this is me, none of this is mine, none is a self. So, for example, I put out will there, because that's supposed to be the most prominent, the Buddha said in the Sanyutta, of the fourth kanda of the mental formations. And if you say will is not mine, now what does that actually mean? It means that this thing which is talking to me now, that which is choosing, is not Ainsley. If it's not Ainsley, what is it? And the Buddha always makes it very clear. It is the cause and effect relationship. It comes from many, many different causes, but it's not coming from a self. It's not yours. Now, when you actually see that there's no me in control of this, that even your will is not me, not mine, not a self, imagine what happens. There has to be a letting go. It has to be an ending of craving, an ending of attachments. When that happens, the process of the five kanda, well, that happens, that's called enlightenment, arahat. The whole process of the five kandas continues until the end of this life. At the end of that life, that's when there's no more birth anymore. That point where the five kandas go to complete cessation, that's where the material form, the body dies, that's gone. That's where the Vedana doesn't arise anymore. There is no more perception. Where will stops once and for all. Where consciousness ceases once and for all. There's no consciousness left. That is very clear, stated by the Buddha. So this is interesting. This is, you think, I will be destroyed. When you realize there's not anyone in there to begin with, there's nothing that's being destroyed. It's just a process, which was only an empty process anyway, has now come to cessation. Which is why the Buddha uses that beautiful word, cessation, rather than destruction. The difference between cessation and destruction, cessation describes a process which just stops, a cause and effect relationship which finally comes to an end. Destruction means there was something there which has been destroyed. So we're not talking about destruction, we're talking about cessation. It's all a process, and the Eightfold Path process is always a little bit here, a little bit there, until one becomes a stream winner. It's at that time, as it says, a stream winner, that's when actually you've really made your raft. That's the time when you launch your raft into the stream. That's when you start to cross. And that's why it's always the right view of seeing oneself is what is perfected first of all. And then you go across, and the end of the path, everything is gone. The raft is gone, and the one who was swimming is gone. That's what it means, abandoning all the states, even the good, let alone the bad. Okay, let's carry on. There's still a while to go, and it's 4:30. The Arahat coming next. So this is the Buddha who's just, he took this little misguided Aritta and just really went to town. It's one of the brilliant suttas. Bhikkhus, this bhikkhu is called one whose shaft has been lifted, whose trench has been filled, whose pillar has been uprooted, one who has no bar, a noble one whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered. These are all like similes which made a lot of sense in those days. I won't go too much through those similes. But he says a little bit here. And how is the bhikkhu one whose shaft has been lifted? Here the monk has abandoned ignorance, has cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it so that it is no longer subject to future arising. That is how the bhikkhu is one whose shaft has been lifted. And how is the bhikkhu one whose trench has been filled? Here the monk has abandoned the round of rebirths, the being renewed being, has cut it off at the root so that it is no longer subject to future arising. That is how the monk is one whose trench has been filled. And how is the bhikkhu one whose pillar has been uprooted? Here the monk has abandoned craving, has cut it off at the root, so that it is no longer subject to future arising. That is how the monk is one whose pillar has been uprooted. And how is the monk one who has no bar? Here the bhikkhu has abandoned the five lower fetters, has cut them off at the root, so they are no longer subject to future arising. That is how the bhikkhu is one who has no bar. And how is the bhikkhu a noble one, whose banner is lowered, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered? Here bhikkhu has abandoned the conceit, I am, has cut it off at the root, so that it no longer is subject to future arising. That is how the bhikkhu is a noble one, whose banner is lowered, like a banner, look at me, whose burden is lowered, who is unfettered. Bhikkhu is when the gods with Indra, with Brahman, with Prajapati, seek a bhikkhu who is thus liberated in mind. They do not find anything for which they could say, the consciousness of one thus gone is supported by this. Why is that? Because I say it is untraceable here and now. What that actually means is it's untraceable in this world, the Ditte Vadhamma. So the consciousness is not supported by anything. Being not supported, it no longer exists. Consciousness needs its supports, cause and effect. So saying, bhikkhu, so proclaiming, I have been baselessly, falsely and wrongly misrepresented by some recluses and Brahmins. Thus, the recluse Gotama is one who leads astray. He teaches the annihilation, the destruction, the extermination of an existing being. As I am not, as I do not proclaim, so I have been baselessly, vainly, falsely and wrongly misrepresented by some recluses and Brahmins. That the recluse Gotama is one who leads astray. He teaches the annihilation, the destruction, and extermination of an existing being. Bhikkhus, both formerly and now, what I teach is suffering and the cessation of suffering. If others, in other words, there's no being, there's just suffering. The causal sequence of suffering. It just teaches suffering and the abandoning of suffering, the cessation of suffering, which is the cessation of the five khandhas. If others abuse, revile, scold and harass the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata on that account feels no annoyance, bitterness or dejection of the heart. And if others honour, respect, revere and venerate the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata, the Buddha on that account feels no delight, joy, elation of the heart. If others honour, respect, revere and venerate the Tathagata for that, the Tathagata on that account thinks thus, they perform such services as these, for the sake of what had earlier come to be fully understood. In other words, they're praising him because they too have understood that. Therefore, monks, if others abuse, revile, scold and harass you on that account, you should not entertain any annoyance, bitterness or dejection of the heart. And if others honour, respect, revere and venerate you on that account, you should not entertain any delight, joy or elation of heart. If others honour, respect, revere and venerate you on that account, you should think thus. They perform such services as these for the sake of what had been earlier come to be fully understood. They've seen that, and that's why they're venerating. So they're not venerating you, they're venerating what's been previously understood. Not yours. Therefore, monks, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. What is it that is not yours? Material form is not yours, including your body. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Feeling is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned Vedana, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Perception is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Formations are not yours. Abandon them. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Again, understanding what abandoning the raft is. Because what do you think? And this is, again, one of the favourite similes. This is why this is one of my great suttas. Because what do you think? If people carried off the grass, sticks, branches and leaves in this jeta grove, or burned them, or did what they liked with them, would you think people are carrying us off, or burning us, or doing what they like with us? No, venerable sir. Why not? Because that is neither ourself nor what belongs to ourself, the twigs and leaves and grass outside. So too, bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. What is it that is not yours? Material form, feeling, perception, formations and consciousness. Abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your wealth and happiness for a long time. Someone wants to steal your consciousness, they can have it. So I often said that if the devil came up and said, I'll give you $1,000 for your soul, Ajahn Brahm, I say, deal, go and put the $1,000 in the donation box, maybe give it to the nuns and monastery. And you can have my soul. Ha ha ha. You've got a bad deal. Abandon it. Give it up. If people take it away, so what? If people take away your happy Vedana, make you upset, it's not yours. They take away your consciousness. They take away your, what else, your perceptions. Take away your body. It's not mine anyway. In this Dhamma, because the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork. And patchwork means when there's a few faults in it, you try and patch it up. You try to fix it up, just like politicians. In the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, open, evident, and free of patchwork, there is no future round for manifestation in the case of those bhikkhus or arahats with taints destroyed. They just can't manifest anymore. Who have lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and are completely liberated through final knowledge. Bhikkhu, the Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, free of patchwork. In this Dhamma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, free of patchwork, those monks who have abandoned the five lower fetters, these are the anagamis, the non-returners, are all due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there attain final nirvana without ever returning from that world. Bhikkhus, the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear fear patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear fear patchwork, those monks who have abandoned the three lower fetters and attenuated lust, hate and delusion are all once returners, returning only once to this world to make an end of suffering. Bhikkhus, the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear fear patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear fear patchwork, those monks who have abandoned the three fetters are all stream winners, or stream enterers, sorry, no longer subject to the lower realms, bound for deliverance and headed for enlightenment. Bhikkhus, the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear fear patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear fear patchwork, those monks who are Dharma followers or faith followers, this is on the path of being a stream winner, are all headed for enlightenment. Bhikkhus, the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus is clear, open, evident, and fear patchwork. In the Dharma well proclaimed by me thus, which is clear, open, evident, and fear patchwork, those monks who have sufficient faith in me, sufficient love for me, are all headed for heaven. Someone must mention that actually shows there is actually a place for just faith. But unfortunately, you've got to be very clear and lucky that you've got faith in the right thing. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, that's one of the heavy suttas. The nice ones, the juicy ones. All starting when somebody said, to sensuality, no problem with that. And the Buddha said, listen here, mate. And he just really let him have it. And he gave some of the most deepest of teachings. The simile of the snake, grasping the teachings in the right place. Simile of the raft, crossing over, and abandoning. And it's beautiful what we had a discussion about, really what abandoning means, what letting go. All based on the sense of self. Remember, when is the hand that has to be picking up, attaching? The only way you can stop attaching is cut off the hand. When you see this non-self, then letting go truly happens. And the Buddha was saying about the standpoints of his views, and in every which way, saying also that sometimes that people get agitated, they get afraid, I am being destroyed by this Buddhism, I am ending, I'm not going to get reborn again, I'd rather get reborn. You see, that's a fear there, and the Buddha said that's a stupidity. When you actually see the Dharma, you're not agitated anymore by these teachings. And then the Buddha was actually saying, just like the twigs and leaves which are lying outside, your five khandhas are no more than that. People take them away, they can have them. That's what we mean by non-attachment. That's what we mean by abandoning. And that way, that one is free once and for all. Okay. Any questions before we finish off? 1, 2, 3. Gone. Okay. So thank you for listening to that discourse. And we can do the Arahang Sammasambuddha together now.
Arahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadeni Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami